Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a responsible day for the 9th of Cheshvan. Today we're going to say two quick tshuvot of the Chatam Sofer. The first is from Chelik Bet of Yoredeya in Kuf Chav Chet, chapter 122 of the second volume of Yoredeya. He's written a question by a man who I think is in Vienna, and he's talking about a Jew who wants to learn the profession of sculpting. Right, he wants to make turn stones into various shapes and various things and sell them. He wants to become an artist. He wants to become a sculptor. And that's a profession in their times, in the early 1800s. This is Tshuva from the 9th of Cheshvan of Tuf Kuf. He writes to this Tuf Kuf Bet Sadi. I think it's because it's Tika Beit. The Jews should be gathered into Israel and should be gathered back together. That would be from 1831. So you've got this young man, he wants to make a profession, and the profession is he wants to learn how to become a sculptor, and then you can make a good living, because you can make sculpt things, you can make sculptures and sell them to various noble courts around Europe and make a living. Problem is that it was well accepted that there's a prohibition to make full statues of human forms, to make a Tzuret Adam Shalem Bolet. Right, so if you want to make to draw a picture of a human being on 2D, right, to make a painting, to draw a picture, that's okay. But if it's bolate, that's considered a form and that is prohibited in 3D. And if you make it, you can't do it. So the problem is, if he already gets to be a professional, it becomes a master craftsman in the trade, then he won't have a problem anymore. Because in any situation where he has to make a sculpture like that, he can hand it off to one of his assistants. He can make sure there's a non-Jewish assistant, a non-Jewish intern, as it were, or apprentice, and he can have them do it. But in the process of training, he has to do it, and he has to do it in front of his, instructor, his master, his morella omanut, his master teacher. And especially if he goes to the academy, which would be a great credential for him, he's going to have to make many of such things in with his hands, with people supervising, to make sure that he can do it. Right? That's part of the process. Today, there's sort of a parallel, which is not going to have any halakhic parallels, because it's a whole different halakhic question, but today you have this, those people want to go to culinary school. Right? So in culinary school, they have to make basar b'chalav, they have to make meat and milk dishes, and they have to make them themselves, because it's part of the training process, and the institute won't certify that they're a master chef, or whatever the degree you get from such institutes, without having seen and supervised them doing it. So this person's going to have to, if he wants to train in the profession with either a master teacher or with the academy, he's going to have to do these kinds of things in front of people. So the question is, what can he do about it? So the person asking the question to this Rav had thought that there's a Gemara that says that you can't learn to do these things, but there are various things that we allow people to learn, lehavin ulahorot, to learn how to do it, and you're able to teach how to do it. So that comes up, we're going to see. It comes up in witchcraft, it comes up in certain Avodah Zorah things. So normally you'd say, well, how come you're allowed to learn about idolatry? Idolatry is prohibited for all Jews. So one of the answers to some that goes some of the way is, you're allowed to learn it, lahavin ulahorot, to know how to do it, and to be able to teach it in order that people understand what this halakhic problem is. So for example, most of us don't need to know what Avodah Zorah is in its fullest form. But if I want to be a Dayan, if somebody wants to be able to judge these kinds of things, they want to become a complete Talmud Chacham, a complete Torah scholar in terms of knowing how these things work for the purposes of judging them and teaching others how to judge them. So there's permission to do it. You're allowed to atalameh lavin ulahorot. So the person asking the question said, so this person is not learning it really because he wants to be a sculptor of these kinds of things. He's only learning it to know how to do it because this academy requires him to know how to do it and to maybe one day be able to teach others how to do it. So the rabbi who was now turning to the Chatam Sofer says, you're right in your response. Your response was that was to learn the halachos of it so you know how to judge the halachos, but to learn how to do it in terms of actually doing it, he says there's no actual right to do that. And the rabbi asking the question of the Chatam Sofer had actually gone a step further, and he said that whole idea of lavin olarot, that we're allowed to learn parts of Torah that we would never be allowed to put into effect for the sake of knowing how to judge them, this rabbi had said that also only applies when we have an actual Sanhedrin. When we have an actual Sanhedrin that can judge these things fully, that's when you have that permissibility. But in a time when we are sadly lacking in a Sanhedrin, then we're not even allowed to learn these areas of halacha fully because we don't have any reason to knowing them. That, the Chasam Sofer says, that's not true. He thinks Lavina Larot applies in all times, and the reason why he believes that is because there's a Gemara that says, Gemara Sanhedrin, Samachet Amad Aleph, that says that Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Akiva were walking together in a field, and Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Akiva, even though they lived somewhat in the time of the Beit HaMikdash, and I think Rabbi Akiva witnessed the Churban, nonetheless, they were certainly after the Sanhedrin had stopped judging capital crimes. Because the tradition is that the Sanhedrin stopped judging capital issues 40 years before the destruction. Rabbi Akiva, for all that he lives a very long life, wasn't that early, because he lives up until the time of Bar Kokhba, we think, as well, which is 60 years after the Churban. So Rabbi Akiva is not around as a Talmud Chacham, as a Torah scholar, when the Sanhedrin is functioning in terms of capital crimes, and yet they're walking along, and Rabbi Eliezer, the Gemara says, taught Rabbi Akiva a certain form of witchcraft called the Tiat Kishuim, that he would speak, and a field would also be planted with beans. It would be full of whatever harvest they wanted. So however you understand that Gemara, in terms of what your belief is about the whether witchcraft actually works or doesn't work, that's a machloket Rishonim. There's a debate among the Rishonim. Rishonim disputed whether or not these things could actually work. That's a whole different discussion. But the point of the Gemara, though, is for our purposes, is Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Eliezer are walking along at a time when the Sanhedrin does not function in terms of punishing these crimes, and yet Rabbi Eliezer felt comfortable that it was appropriate to teach Rabbi Akiva this area of halacha, lehorot, in order to understand it, to know what it was, and to be able to pasken halacha on it. So too, Rabbi Hanina ben Tradyon lived after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, and he taught another halacha about what it means to pronounce the name of Hashem in its fullest form with all of its letters, and that's for the purposes of judging things like Birchat Hashem, like blasphemy, and things like that. So Chatham Sofer says, so basically that shows us that even in a time when we're not able to judge these things practically in terms of a court and punishments, we nonetheless are required to know all of Torah if we can, and we're supposed to learn all of this stuff, and those of us who are up to that piece of learning have the right to learn it for the sake of knowing and understanding all of Torah. Dirosh v'kabel sakar, the learning of Torah is always valuable, even if it can't right now be put into practice. That would be obviously true for things where there's no problem learning them, like the way the Korbanot work, the way the sacrifices work, the Beit HaMikdash. There were laws, the full laws of Kohanim, of the priests at the time, all of those laws, obviously, every degree that you should learn and are appropriate to learn. The question was here, areas of halacha where there's some problem in studying them, and that they are areas of studying matters of sin, and you might have thought, we don't want to get into that. Chatham Sofer is disagreeing with his correspondent, saying, no, we're allowed to learn and study that even now, even in a time when we can't put it into practice. And then the man who had written the letter to the Chatham Sofer said he thought that maybe that the Rambam had left out this halacha of Lahavinu Lahorot, that we're allowed to study certain things, things that we would never be allowed to put into practice ourselves. We're allowed to study and know them in order to be able to judge them and know how they work. So this man has suggested maybe that's why the Rebbe left out that idea, because we live in a post-Sanhedrin time. We live in a time when courts don't judge these things. So that's an odd claim. The Chasam Sofer is going to answer going to be no, the Rambam did include it. We'll see it in a second. But it's also an odd claim because the Rambam didn't limit his book to those areas that apply in his time. So that's an interesting question that the Chasam Sofer doesn't choose to get into. The Chasam Sofer says it's not true, because if you look in the 8th chapter of Chod Avodah Zarah, that's where he should have written it, perhaps. Chasam Sofer says, but back in Hilchos Sanhedrin, or in Hilchos Sanhedrin, not back, in Hilchos Sanhedrin, the Rambam had written that the members of the Sanhedrin have to know other wisdoms. They can't just know Torah, they have to know other wisdoms as well in order to be able to judge various kinds of areas like, and the Rambam says there, Ovdei Avodah Zarah and Mechashefa, idolaters and witches, and those who do those forms of witchcraft. So it shows you that in Sanhedrin he said that they have to learn it in order to be able to know how to judge it. So he also said it in Hilchos Avodah Zarah a little bit, where he says to make a tsura, to make a statue, to make a form of an Avodah Zarah for noi, for the beauty of it, That's not allowed. The Rambam writes, but he does write that you're allowed to do it. Lavin ule. That implies, the Chazal Zohar says, it implies that if you had a different purpose in doing it, such as Lavin ule wrote, if you were going to make a statue just for the purpose of knowing what kinds of statues idolaters make in order to be able to judge what qualifies or what doesn't qualify, that, the Chazal Zohar says, the Rambam seems to imply would be okay. Then the Chassid Sofer says, but it's odd because in Perek Gimel Halacha Yud of Hilchos Avodah Zarah, the Rambam writes, and the Smag writes something similar, that you're not allowed to make statues, forms that could theoretically have been for Avodah Zarah, even for their beauty. And then he writes, the reason you're not allowed to do that is Kidosh Lo Yit'u Vahem Ato'im V'Yizberu Shehim Shalako. That people don't make the mistake of thinking that you made it and you're holding on to it as an item of idolatry. He says that's very strange. Devada, he says, Eina kavana shibishum kashad nesar. It's not that it's not allowed because people will suspect you of it. Like if you found, let's say, a tsura, a statue of some sort, and you're going to hold on to it for its beauty, it's got to be, the Chassid Sofer says, the Rambam means that you can't make them because you're going to lead in the future. Maybe people will actually worship it. It's not, Shemi to Atoim, it's not, maybe people will make a mistake. It's maybe people who are willing to worship Avodah Zarah will use this to worship it. And so that would mean that if somebody made this form and then immediately broke it or destroyed it, or even just took out an eye, because the tradition is that meaning this is not yet an item of Avodah Zarah. So if before it's an item of Avodah Zarah, I ruin it, so I don't have to destroy it completely. As long as it's ruined, that it can't be an item of Avodah Zarah anymore, that should be enough. And therefore, theoretically, that would mean that if somebody wants to make such forms and then destroy them right away, that would be a big kula. And he's inferring from the Rambam that would be a tremendous leniency because he thinks that we think that it's from the time of doing it that the prohibition is. Even if you break it afterwards, the prohibition was to make them the lav. And so how could the Rambam come up with this idea that he's got a leniency that, no, if you made it and broke it and destroyed it right away, that it would be okay. So the Chassam Sofer suggests that the Rambam is actually following something else the Rambam had already written elsewhere in Perek Gimel, earlier in the third chapter of Hilchos Avodah Zarah. The Rambam had written that if somebody worships idolatry, me'ahava. This is a Gemara, it talks about worshiping me'ahava. The question is, what does me'ahava mean? The Rambam's understanding of me'ahava, worshiping out of love, since others read it as worshiping out of love of a person, meaning I like so-and-so, so-and-so likes to worship Avodah Zarah, so I go along with that so-and-so, with that person, I go along with him. I don't mean it as Avodah Zarah at all. I'm not worshiping in any way whatsoever. I'm just doing what they're doing because I like them. So that's a whole question of its own. The Gemara seems to say such a person is putter, is not fully liable for Avodah Zarah because they aren't really worshiping. The Rambam understood Ahava is Gagon Shechashak to Razo Mipnei Malakdashi Nabiyoter. I just got so attached to that statue or that form because it's so beautiful. So the Rambam says, if that leads me to decide that it's a deity or a form of control over my life, an Elohut power, that's Avodah Zarah. That's idolatry, and that person would be liable for the death penalty by stoning. But if the person never accepted it, but worshipped it in one of the ways that people were, in the way it is worshipped, or in the one of the ways that we could worship Hashem from the four special modes of worship of Hashem, so then that person is putter. Why are they putter? The Rambam's understanding the Gemara today, it's a difficult Rambam, because I think the majority opinion, I think, is that if we bow down to anything, even if we don't intend to worship it, and we bow down to it, and it's an item of worship, and we bow down to it in a way that others bow down, you know, I think most people think that's idolatry, and that's a problem. The Rambam seems to think that if a person is not have any intent that this has any power over him or her, that it's not in any way a deity, it's not in any way a form of power, and he's bowed down to it just as an expression of respect and admiration for its beauty, they don't think that person is putter. I guess it's a complicated other question of what is Zohar, but that's not our topic here. But the Chassam Sofer says, but putter, means you're not liable for punishment, but it's certainly got to be prohibited, even according to Rambam. And certainly Rambam would think that it's not a good thing to do. But that leads us to back to our question, because he says, maybe then when the Rambam writes later, that when you make a form, that it's a problem because maybe people make the mistake afterwards. He says, maybe the Rambam was referring back to this halakha, that I'm making something, I'm making a statue of some sort, or a form of some sort, I'm making it for its beauty. That the Rambam is saying, we worry that after finishing it, it'll be so beautiful that the person will get so attached to it, or other people around him will get attached to it, and they'll bow down to it, even though they have no intent of worshiping it as a power. And we just said that's prohibited to do. It may be that the person is putzer, but it's prohibited to do such a thing. And if that's true, then it's prohibited to do it, even if the plan is to break it immediately. Because the worry is, you'll get so attached to it that you'll break it, that you won't break it. You'll bow down to it, and then maybe then you'll break it, but you already bowed down to it. Even though that it's putter, even though it's not fully liable, it's still a problem. But the Chazal Sofer adds, that might only be with tzurot that are otherwise worshipped, right? The person's going to make a form, make a meaning, everybody else makes, you know, icons of whatever god it is, of the Buddha, let's say. And they all make Buddhas. So I'm planning on making a Buddha only because I think I can make a beautiful Buddha. And I have no intention to worship it to it, and even if I to bow down to it, and even if I bow down to it, I would never even think that the Buddha has any real power. And that's what I'm doing. So the Rambam says, no, that's prohibited. The reason why that would be prohibited is because if the person or other people around get so attached to how beautiful it is, and they bow as an expression of its beauty and how beautiful it is, while they're not liable for avodah zarah, for idolatry, they are nonetheless doing something that's prohibited, and therefore the person is not allowed to make it to begin with, even if the plan is to then destroy it. That's the way he understands those Rambam, although he agrees that that's not, in that itself is still not an easy reading of the Rambam, and it still doesn't solve all the problems. That's the way he understands the Rambam. Nonetheless, coming back to our issues, he doesn't know of a way to allow this person to do it in the academy, to make these statues, because these are things that are sometimes worshipped. Forms of human beings are always a problem and an issue of worship, so he doesn't know of a real way to do it, unless, he says, the only thing he can think is that he's going to find a way that when his time comes to make such a thing under supervision, he doesn't make it all the way. If he makes it but leaves it with one eye out, so it's not yet finished, and if it's not yet finished, it's not an item that anybody would worship because it's not complete, and he leaves it for one of the other students to finish it, the non-Jewish students to finish it, so he thinks that could work. Meaning, you can't, so it would be, to go back to our Culinary Institute parallel, which isn't quite a parallel, if there was a way to do all the steps of the process of cooking, except for the ones that involve mixing the meat and the milk. That's much, much harder in the case of cooking, but here, that's what the customer is saying. If, you know, they come to supervise me that day, and they're going to watch me all day sculpting, and I have to, you know, however long it takes to sculpt something, and I have to sculpt a person. So what I should do is I should sculpt and sculpt and sculpt and show them my skill and pass or get a great grade. But as soon as they go away, as soon as I'm done, I make sure not to be done in all the ways. I leave something significant missing such that it could clearly not yet be an item of worship. And that last piece I leave for somebody else to do. If I could do it that way, Chatham Sofer thinks there's room to say that that's permissible. Then the person can learn the skill and profession of sculpting and not violate the Torah and then go off and make a living, and that's where he hopes for. So that is the first of our two tshuvot, L'chatzim Sofer, on the 9th of Cheshvan. This is from 1831, about the ability to sculpt things without running afoul of problems of Avodah Zarah. Another tshuva from 4 years later, 1835, Tav Kuf Tzadi Vav. This is published in the fifth volume of Chatzim Sofer, Choshen Mishpat Kuf Bet 102. Let's suppose somebody sold a bunch of their possessions. Okay, so the problem now is going to be, when can we assume we know what you're thinking? And the general answer is, we generally in halacha don't assume we know what you were thinking, and we're not allowed to use what you were thinking as part of our evaluation of certain things. So the case can happen, it happens at the Gemara, there's a similar case that we'll get to. The case here was, man wants to sell some stuff. He wants to sell things, he wants to buy a big vat in which to cook or to prepare vodka, right? There's some, whatever the processes are, you have to heat things up, you have to hold on to things or ferment things, all that process, whatever it is. It took various specialized tools to make such things. So he wanted to So that's a cost. He's going to sell some of his possessions in order to be able to buy one of those things to start a business, right? It would be like, you know, that's basically what we're talking about. The man wants to buy the materials for a business. In this case, the business is making vodka and schnapps and things like that, and that's the business he wants to enter into. So he needs the materials for it. That's going to have a cost. He sells some items, and it's clear, he makes it clear that he's doing it for the purpose of starting this business in selling these items. He doesn't make it a condition, but he says it. The guy says, you know, why would you sell your baseball card collection you've had since you were 7 years old? He says, oh, because I'm starting a business in schnapps making, and I need the materials, and I need the tools, I need the instruments, I need, you know, the hardware, so I'm selling it. So before the sale is complete in the following way, he got the money from the man who was buying the items, but he has not yet delivered the card collection. That's the example I'm using. Obviously, they didn't have baseball cards back then. I hope it's obvious. If it's not obvious, you should contact me and let me know, grothst@gmail.com, that you didn't understand that, but all in all, I'll explain it to you. The brother of this person passed away, and the brother had already been in the business. So the brother had all the items that he needed, right? He had a whole factory already. So this man inherited a whole factory of schnapps baking, all of the things he needed to do it. So he doesn't want to go through with it because now he wants to keep his baseball card collection. So he wants to return the money and keep the things. So Chasam Sofer says, so the truth is, the way that you're asking the question, there was no completed act of acquisition. Remember that in halacha, like in other area, like in other legal systems, sale isn't complete until there's an act of acquisition. So whatever the act of acquisition is, that's the question, right? Because the sale is not complete until then. It comes up in all sorts of areas where one or side or the other wants to abrogate the sale, wants to interrupt the sale and stop it from taking effect. The question will be, at what point has it taken effect such that they can do that? So here, there are a lot of ways of acquisition on halacha. When it comes to movable property, you know, chairs, tables, whatever it is, baseball cards, apples, pens, computers, any kind of movable property. So there's a bunch of ways to take possession. One is to actually take physical possession, hagbah, to lift the item and take possession of it. Sometimes, though, it's not around to do that quickly, or it can be heavy sometimes, or it can be this. There's all sorts of reasons why that would be an inconvenient form of acquisition. So there are other forms of acquisition, such as chalipin. Chalipin is, if we trade items in halacha, that takes effect even if the trade is only done with one item. You'll sometimes see this, for example, in selling chametz for Pesach, selling leavened bread for Pesach, when we want to appoint the rabbi, our messenger, to do it, he'll give you an item of his, he'll give the person an item of his, and that person will lift it. By taking possession of the pen or the handkerchief, that effectuates a trade. And the right the original person had to own their chametz in terms of selling it, own their leaven in terms of the right to sell that, has now been transferred to the rabbi. The rabbi now has, not transferred fully, but has been appointed a messenger to sell a chametz. So that can happen with lots of things. So if I have a car that you want to buy, and you're going to give me the money now, but you want to take possession now, even though it's not right here, so you can give me your pen, and halachically, by giving me your pen, we can trade. I get the pen, you get the car. It doesn't have to be of the same value at all. That's chalipin. Another way to do it is what's called a kinyan agav. If I can transfer to you some of my landed property, then I can include in that sale not landed, movable property, even if it's not on the land itself. That's all discussion in the Gemara, but that's the way we pass it. So if I have landed property, in fact, there was a time for hundreds of years, Jews would sometimes use their four amot that they had in Eretz Israel. The tradition was that every Jew owns land in Israel in terms of being buried in Israel, and people would do kinyanim with that. They would, if I want to transfer ownership of movable property, if I have a computer that I have a car, let's go stick with my car that I'm selling you, and I want to get you possession of it, I can give you possession of my landed property, and then by selling you the land selling the car, I got the land, I can get it to you. The reason why we would do that is because it's easier to buy land, because land is bought with money. So if you give me money and I say I'm selling you my land, and then on top of that the car, so that would have take immediate effect, and then I'd hopefully get my land back, and however it would work, right? So in this case, it doesn't seem to be that any of that was done. It was kesef below mashicha. There was no taking possession of it. So then he says, so then, yeah, he can go back, because until the acquisition is completed, you can, either side, can renege on it. However, there is a tradition that if people do that, because they're not supposed to, because if I gave you money for something and I expected that I was going to be able to take possession of it, and then you change your mind after I've given you the money for whatever reason, so that's upsetting, and there are situations where I'm allowed to issue what's called a misha para. I'm allowed to issue a call that a Kadosh Baruch Hu, that Hashem, who punished the people of Sodom, or sometimes the door of the generation of the flood, for not having been financially appropriate, that I can call that kind of punishment on people who do this, or I can call that person, and society will call that person, somebody who's untrustworthy, muhusar amana. So people don't want to get that reputation. So the person, so the Chasam Sofer says, so the person who's asking the question is saying, can I go back on the deal without, not only halakhically, technically, legally, because there are people, good people, who care not only about whether they're legally able to do something, but whether they can do so and still retain a sense of themselves and have other people retain a sense of them as being trustworthy people, as being the kinds of people we want to deal with. So the Chasam Sofer points out there are situations in halakha. It's a debate between the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah. If the prices change on an item after we agreed on a sale, so there's a discussion about whether it might be only for landed property, but the Shulchan Aruch held that it was even for movable property. The price changes significantly between the moment of sale and the completion of the sale, that the person who's affected by it does have the right to go back on it, and that's not considered a mishapar, a mekusar amana, a lactor's trustworthiness, because they were in the middle of an actual sale. And what's not like, you know, sometimes you'll say, well, that's the whole point of investment. So that's a discussion you can have. But the Shulchan Aruch seems to say that if the price changes significantly in a way that wasn't expected, then going back on it is not considered being untrustworthy. So the person could theoretically just say, well, I hold like the Shulchan Aruch, even though that person is an Ashkenazic Jew, they're living in Europe, and they almost definitely tend to follow the views of the Ramah. There is a right in halakha on certain matters, on matters of dispute, to sometimes say, well, I hold like that other opinion, because it serves me better, obviously, but that's a right, and that's not considered being a person who's untrustworthy. But once we got into the situation, he also says, but now that you came to me with this question, the real question, the meaning, so the customers are saying there's ways for the person to do it, having nothing to do with the fact that we assume he only meant to sell it to begin with because of his need to buy the equipment for his new business. But that question, once it's raised, because let's talk about it a little bit, because this is actually a complicated question. He doesn't come to full answers, but he raises a few issues for us to be aware of and to think about. There's a Gemara that talks about somebody who sells all of their possessions because they plan to move to Eretz Yisrael. So, and the Gemara there says that if he doesn't get to go, then the fact that he sold it with that in mind is very clear to us, and therefore he has the right to go back on it and to say, no, I only sold it for that reason, and therefore now that it's not working out, I'm not planning, I want to reverse the sale and might be allowed. Rashi there says that's only about landed property because we have a good assumption that people don't sell their land, their houses, their, you know, their things, unless they really do intend to move. And therefore, in the selling, there's sort of an implication that there was an intention to move. And since there was an implication already in the sale, there was intent to move. If he doesn't get to move, that would be a way to think that maybe the sale was implicitly on condition of being able to move. But when it comes to movable property, there are lots of things, reasons that people sell, you know, computers and chairs and tables and cars and whatever they sell. So even according to Rashi, the Chassidim are saying, even if the person says out loud, this is why I'm doing it, that doesn't yet become a condition within the sale. It doesn't yet become so embedded within the sale that we would say, well, so if it didn't work out, it didn't work out. If he said it with a t'nai, right? So that would be different. You made a condition of it. Now, we're coming to condition. Some people hold you to need a tonight kuffle. The person has to make the condition as, if this happens, then this, and if this doesn't happen, then that. But some people hold, no, you say, if this happens, then I'm selling it to you. So if you did that, that would be different. But the question is, just the fact that this guy mentions, you know, I would never have sold this collection. I've had this baseball collection since I was a little kid, and I have such sentimental attachment to it, but I want to start a business, so what can I do? So just saying that would not be enough, according to Rashi, when it comes to mitaltlin, to movable property, for us to say that that's become an implicit condition of the sale. If that were true, and that would be, and the sale had already gone through then, Rashi would seem to hold that the fact that the person has not, if the person has mentioned that, would not be enough for him to say, oh, you know what, I want to go back on the sale, because it was not embedded into it, it didn't become a part of it in that way. And the Chasam Sofer says, and that, by the way, is the basis of our mechiras chametz, of our selling chametz before Pesach, because it's very clear to everybody, if we go by umdinas, by what we know to be the state of mind of the people involved, it's very clear that the non-Jew who's buying the chametz doesn't really plan to buy the chametz. So the Chassam says, yes, but we say, dvarim shebalev, einam dvarim, that things that are internal, that you're just thinking, aren't considered matters. Now, it happens to be the Chassam Sofer seems to be saying that according to Rashi, we have to worry about other opinions as well. According to Rashi, even if the non-Jew said it at the time of the sale, it would be, as long as you didn't make a condition of it, it would be okay. But others hold differently. Others hold that saying it might be good enough, and therefore we won't get into that. But the whole idea that just because we know that somebody's thinking something, that doesn't necessarily affect our halakhic actions and halakhic sales, that's an important point here that he's getting out of this, and therefore it would not be true that his having mentioned it in the course of trying to sell his baseball card collection to build his schnapps business would be enough to allow him the right to return and renege on the sale if matters change, if situation changes that he inherits it instead of needing to buy it. So we're running out of time when we get into all of this. The Chassam doesn't come down on any, determinations, decisions. He says that there are situations where we seem to somewhat go by what we know the person to be thinking, others where we don't, and against the various situations, some of them that Chazal mentions explicitly, those we certainly can use, some they didn't, and that's more complicated, and that's a whole sugya of its own. But fundamentally, this person, since the sale didn't complete, is going to find himself able to go back on it because of the technical issues, and even if he doesn't want to be considered untrustworthy, there's room to allow that as well. So that is a tshuva of the Chassam Sofer, talking a little bit about what we do and don't expect, infer from people's actions, and about when sales complete for the ninth of Cheshvan. And that is two responses of the Chassam Sofer for a response of a day. Have a great day.